Welcome to the Chain Stories Podcast, the podcast that celebrates disruptors who defy convention. Here, we dive into the bold stories of trailblazers who turned audacious ideas into billion-dollar ventures. From digital assets to transformative innovations, brought to you by Dropout Capital, we believe the path to success isn't always conventional. So whether you're a student, a founder, or just curious, these are the stories of fearless innovators redefining what's possible.
Okay, we're live. So great to have you today, Nick. It was a pleasure meeting you in Lisbon at Crypto AI Con. Very interesting what you're doing at Tyrim. And I think for our audience, why don't you start by giving us a brief story of how did you got into the crypto space? Where did you work before? And how did you decide, okay, I'm going in full time into this industry? This makes a lot of sense. It's an opportunity of a century.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure meeting you in Portugal as well. I got involved in crypto in university, actually. I was studying finance and engineering. The first time I actually came across it was in 2011. And I was lying on the bed of one of my uni mates. And I remember he was a techie. He was studying something in tech, right? And he was so much on the cutting edge of anything technology. And he was telling me about Bitcoin. And I was the first year economics student. I remember thinking, I could see how that could have merit. I could see how that could work in the future. And that's all I thought of it until I was getting towards the final years of uni and Bitcoin was pushing. And I was like, shit. So I remembered thinking about it back then. I didn't act. And I was like, I gotta do something now.
You're 14 or 2017?
14. So I started dabbling with it then. But it wasn't really until 2016 that I started to look at it seriously. And in 2016, we were kind of in a similar position to where we are now in the market cycle, where BTC was just about to go into its final year of bullishness. And the market cycle is actually the backbone of all the frame, builds a large portion of the framework I use for ever thinking about crypto. But nonetheless, 2016 was a bullish year for Bitcoin. It was an even more bullish year for Ethereum. And I was actually getting long Ethereum at the time. Come 2017, I was getting a lot more long BTC and Ethereum. And then you had ICOs start to pop off. And then you had, the proper first real adoption cycle going towards the end of 17 there, followed by a bear market, which was pretty brutal. I think I, like many people, were actually going, shit, is this thing ever going to come back? Because that was the first time I was actually all in on crypto. So end of 2016, end of 2017, I was officially a crypto guy. And I've been here ever since, just trading cryptos, learning how it all works.
And were you in school at that time in 2016, 17, or you already graduated and had your first job out in the market?
So I was working with a boutique investment bank in Australia. And I was also still heavily involved in running the trading club of my uni. So I started the trading club in my uni, which is a separate story, but it's actually it's actually the reason beyond me just getting into that conversation I had in 2014. I wanted to be a trader and my university was teaching me how to price options and bonds and how to think long-term about equities, which is all great stuff to know, but when you're in your early 20s, that's really boring. And I was like, I need something higher energy. So I started to teach myself how to trade and I basically started this trading club. It grew very fast. I think we were the largest trading club in Australia.
What was the university name?
QUT. It's a Queensland University of Technology. So I was running that, and what else can I tell you? Essentially, we modeled it off a local hedge fund, and we would get fund managers and bankers coming out to do lectures for us on this is how you actually do it. The stuff they're teaching you in university is nice from a theoretical perspective, but it's not what is going to make you money. You know what I mean? The money that you want to make when you're a young 20-year-old. Sure, the methodologies are tried and tested, and they're consistent. And that's probably why university is teaching you it, and they do have merit, but knowing that is worthless in crypto, apart from maybe trying to price an option. But you got to think differently about those in crypto as well. So they would come in and teach us how to, like, they were trading Forex markets and equities and macro, like heavy macro traders. So I structured the club off the funds, and that club had equities team, commodities team, currencies team. And I sat on top of it. And then I had these heads reporting to me, and they had juniors underneath them. And we would all analyze and share information on the market together. And we actually were profitable, which was quite cool. And then we would do some lectures. But one day we started to dabble into crypto. That started to snowball. And that was when I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is something.
And that's something. What was your perspective? You're working at a boutique investment firm. And in 2017, you see this new asset class emerging and probably over 100x in returns. Mm. Nothing that we ever seen in another industry. Mm. How sort of your reaction or the reaction of your peers when that happened?
Yeah, we were watching it seriously from the second half of 2016, somewhere in there. And we expected it to be really bullish. We were all drinking the Kool-Aid of this is revolutionary. And it was when the ICOs started popping off and you could just buy something in 100x within a week or something like that, is when you started to get all the retail interest, right? When all the retail interest started coming in, that's when I started to get I just felt uneasy. At the time, to be honest, I didn't really understand why I felt uneasy. It was after the bear market, I understood why I felt uneasy, but we were in there spending a lot of time learning about this stuff and weren't making like life-changing gains. And then you would have some random guy that you'd meet at the pub, like, yeah, I just made $1 million. And you're like, this just, something doesn't feel right about it. This doesn't add up. And obviously when retail's coming in and when you're at the pub or you're like, you get in a taxi and the taxi driver's giving you tips, generally when you're at that level of retail, so I've learned cycle after cycle, is you're at the peak, right? And you have to be very cautious. And I've applied that, the lessons I took from that 2017 peak, through into the last peak, and I always hold them in the back of my mind. Like, when you're in a position where people are talking about crypto that shouldn't be, you have to get out. And the first time I actually read about it was, again, it wasn't a uni, it was in a financial book. I think it was Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, where they say, when the shoeshine boy is giving you stock tips, it's time to get out. In my case, it was at a New Year's party. In the New Year's, going from 2017 to 2018, I was at a rave in Amsterdam, and I left at 5 a.m. as you do. And I was like sitting on a stair somewhere out the front of the venue. My buddy, who I was trading very closely with at the time, was having a conversation with someone just off in the distance. And just how obscene it was, like what they were discussing about cryptos and the type of the character this guy was. I was just like, that's the absolute top signal. Let's get out now. Fortunately, we did. We got up pretty close to the top. And last cycle wasn't much different. I think once I have multiple like Uber drivers telling me they're quitting to trade cryptos, I'm like, okay, like that's too many in one area. Now I'm just starting to de-risk. And that paid me well as well. So again, I'm like super, super focused on retail, because retail bring that liquidity that just gets hypnotized by up and just market bids and bids and sends everything to the moon. And if you understand how they're going to trade or where their liquidity is going to flow, then you can position ahead of it, right? Like anyone who's been through a cycle or two or three knows the flow, where you get the push in the majors, then you get the push in the miners, and then like the micro caps, and then it recycles, right? That's always the trade. But if you think about what that trade is, it's just what's hot, what's the next hot thing, and what can I buy to just get that return? And once that flywheel picks up, it's largely driven by retail. So I spend a lot of time thinking about how they're going to flow and like how they're going to flow this cycle, because this cycle's drastically different to previous cycles, right?
Exactly. I was about to ask that. Do you think the retail, it's there, it's coming? It's been a year of meme coin frenzy. And we have all these screenshots posted all over social media with gains. And 2 days ago, we had high school kids making 30K, and that was turning to $2 million. So is retail coming on or still not?
I don't think they're here yet. Retail is here, but it's not here like it will be in about, you know, 6 to 10 months. Like at that point, it's going to be insane. Now, like I said, this cycle will be different. It's going to be different because when you think about the dynamics of supply and demand, and I think deeply about this always, right? It's like these two functions is all I think about, right? But you can apply supply and demand to the determining price. That's what price is, the intersection of supply and demand, okay? So let's think about the supply and demand in sense of capital and supply of projects. And then I'll take you from the 2014 cycle. Like I said, I first started to think about it, the 2017 cycle, the 2020 cycle, and then now. So in 2014, when crypto still was very fringe at that point, the first sort of wave we had come through was really like a pool of like fringe capital coming into some new exchanges, which you didn't need a KYC for. You could just set up an account and you could buy maybe 50 tokens at the most, right? There just wasn't much to buy, but you had a lot of capital come into something that didn't necessarily have much liquidity. It's going to drive it higher simply because you don't have supply there ready to meet the demand. Go forward to 2017, you had a similar dynamic where you had around 600 projects on CoinMarketCap at the peak of the cycle. Within that, you could essentially go onto basically any exchange, right? You had Binance, Bittrex, Bitfinex, BitMEX, Poloniex. You had a bunch, right? But the key thing is you could access them anywhere and you didn't need to KYC. So you really could easily put money in. No matter where you were in the world, you could put money into 600 products. At the peak of last cycle, there were 11,000 tokens on CoinMarketCap. And still, you could essentially make an exchange account anywhere in the world with relatively little KYC, put money in and buy something, right? So if you think about this dynamic, you've had an extremely large pool of capital coming into a small investable universe, i.e. supply and demand. Huge demand, limited supply. Huge demand, limited supply. Huge demand, limited supply. Where are we today? There's a bit of a divergence between Bitcoin and Ethereum and the altcoin market, which I'll dive into. But broadly, the dynamic shifted because since around 21, 22, exchanges have been shut off systematically, particularly in the West, right? On-ramps have been shut down. It's harder to get capital into the space. If it's harder to get capital into the space, then that investable pool of capital shrinks because now when someone goes to the pub and tells their friend that they just made a 10X on whatever coin, that guy has to go, I want to buy some crypto. How does he do it? He's got these limited exchanges that he can get into. And then on those exchanges is a limited pool of assets to trade. Crossing the hurdle into DeFi is actually quite a large barrier to entry to the majority of retail. So what's going to happen this cycle for the alts particularly is I believe that we're going to still see the big push in alts, right? But what assets are going to pop off? What are the characteristics of an asset that's going to pop off are going to be unique because this huge investment pool of capital, there's more awareness of crypto now than ever before, but it all has to funnel through these small pool of on-ramps into a small pool of projects. And there's this whole other universe of altcoins on these exchanges, like all the DEXs, but even SEXs that are shut off from the West now. And a lot of those projects, I don't think are going to get as much bid as they used to. Okay. Just because of on-ramping.
Do you think since Ethereum is in a lot of SEXs in the West, there's a lot of disposable income, like the United States, the country with the highest disposable income in the world, could that still fuel a massive altcoin rally in the sense that, sure, people come into Ethereum and then from there use all the DeFi that exists, all the rails that were built on the DEXs and et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, I think ETH and BTC will diverge a lot more than they have in previous cycles from the alt market, maybe just in momentum and consistency, apart from the major caps, is because of the ETF. If you're a fund manager in the US or anywhere in the world, and you're following the policies of the incoming President Trump, and you're hearing what he's saying and watching what he's doing, you have to buy Bitcoin. You don't have a choice. Whether you like it or not, you have to allocate to Bitcoin because when you have the most powerful economy in the world saying that they're going to put like a head of crypto in their cabinet, that by just simply the virtue of that, they're going to be pro crypto. There's going to be more investment into crypto. And how do you get exposed to crypto? You buy the Bitcoin ETF. Right now, to talk about the dynamic between the investable universe and the investable pool of capital, you've now unlocked the largest pool of liquidity ever in the history of the world, the US sort of financial system, and put it into crypto. Take 1%, 0.1%, whatever. All of these funds need to allocate. They don't have a choice now. Otherwise, their LPs are going to get pissed off and they might underperform. And if you read the writing on the wall, the US is going to change its stance. Fingers crossed it does. Markets try and price in the future. They're not concerned about the policies yet. They just know that they're coming, so they want to get long. So that's Bitcoin. So what is the only other ETF available? It's Ethereum. So once these fund managers get comfortable with Bitcoin, the next logical trade is Ethereum. It just has to happen. So now we're getting this dynamic back in the sense that you're going to get the big push on Bitcoin, the big push on ETH, but because of the amount of liquidity that can flow into these markets, the duration and momentum of the move might be bigger than anything we've ever seen. That's the super cycle thesis. But I don't think it's going to be a super cycle for alts. Like what we've seen this cycle, which we haven't seen in previous cycles, is a glut of narrative and projects. And like I was talking about the projects, like I said, 11,000 in 21, there's just over 2.5 million roughly projects on CoinMarketCap now. And that's just CoinMarketCap. Think about how many are coming out. Sol meme coins are coming out on a daily basis. The investable universe of projects is enormous. It's absolutely enormous. So if you think about dollar per bid per project now as a ratio, it's quite small for alts. Because of the on-ramping issue I discussed earlier, liquidity in the space, i.e. stablecoin reserves, haven't really changed all that much cycle to cycle. So the money that was in the system is the money that is in the system. We haven't had that much new money in the system. And I'm still talking specifically about the altcoin market, not about BTC and ETH, because the dynamics I just discussed will lead them to be something else, right? So if the amount of capital in the space hasn't changed all that much, it proves that retail hasn't arrived yet, but they will come. But it shows that everyone trading this stuff is essentially a crypto native now rather than a crypto tourist. And you've got this huge PVP nature where people just want to buy something and flip it. And as a result, the capital itself has become extremely narrative hungry. And that's why in this cycle, maybe we've cycled through about six narratives, whereas in the 2021 cycle, we had about three narratives, right? DeFi, GameFi, NFTs. Now we've had AI, memes, RWA, DPIN, L2s, ordinals. Like there's probably going to be a lot more as well. And of course, that's a consequence of the network effect of as the technology becomes stronger, there's more capacity to build and innovate on top of it. So there's going to be more and more narratives, but the money itself in the system wants to flip and chase the next narrative. And that's why I think people like memes, because they have the crypto casino element. People in this industry love to punt. No one reads the white paper, remember? No one knows what the stuff does. They just want to buy it because someone said it's going to go up. And if it goes up, they buy it, right? Now they want to flip it. So the momentum slowed down. And I think that's the dynamic we're in for a lot of altcoins now and just the altcoin market in general. Like you're going to see these shorter, sharper moves into the narrative and then into the next coin and into the next narrative to the backdrop of what could potentially be the BTC ETH supercycle.
Going back to previous cycles, we've seen that we had DeFi summer and that got super amplified when it was actually the bull market at the peak when Bitcoin reached those 60K. Is this something we can see potentially now, 6 months from now, this meme coin cycle getting even more amplified, or it will end and hey, let's get a new narrative to come in?
I think it's always important to reference the narrative because once retail enters, and we'll see that by aggregate stablecoin holdings increasing, on-ramping increasing, once they're here, what are they going to do? If you're fresh in the space, where do you start? You ask your friend who told you he just did a 10X. You go and Google, how do I buy Bitcoin? Which is a great analog for like how the market's performing. You can check how the search is on that. I'd suggest everyone look at that. So how do I buy it? You're going to get hit with the on-ramps first. Once you get into the on-ramp, then what do? You go, okay, I've got some money. What am I going to buy? I'm going to buy Bitcoin because Bitcoin's going up. Bitcoin might go up, but then you see something else come, so you buy that. So that's how retail gets in. They're going to do their own research at some point. When they do their research, they see what's flying. When they see what's flying and what has been flying, they're eventually going to go to the fact that they need to buy meme coins. And they're just going to buy the major cap meme coins, so they will continue to flourish. The major cap meme coins on sexes, major sexes now, will perform really well simply because of the reflexivity involved with retail coming in and hearing that they're good and buying them. They will all perform well. That means memes will be here to stay for this cycle. AI as well, like NVIDIA's been performing amazingly well. Everyone's talking about AI, so it's just a natural thing to go, I'm going to look for some AI coins to buy. The DPIN, the RWA, those narratives are maybe still a bit immature, but also to these people who are coming in to buy these assets, they're not as exciting because the DPIN RWA stuff, particularly, I think it's revolutionary. I think it's here to stay. I think DPIN is the future. I'm very pro DPIN. Do I think DPIN is going to go and reach its crazy peak this cycle? No, like I love it, but by the virtue of these DPIN networks growing and actually having physical infrastructure, it's going to be a lot slower, right? The adoption's a lot slower. So it's not just going to fly like these other things do. If you want to be like a value investor in crypto, you buy DPIN in the bear market because the strong DPIN projects that are going to be like getting infrastructure out globally and building these networks, you want to own that, right?
I think that was a great thing that you mentioned, DPIN. And I actually had a personal talk with a Solanas co-founder, Anatoly. And Anatoly mentioned in crypto, there is a lack of this real world utility. Like my parents don't understand what I do. And having projects out there that you can actually share your wireless plan and map real cities, I think that really brought this utility or this value to the normal person, to retail, that they now can finally see the benefits of a decentralized technology. And I share the same thesis with you.
Yeah, and it's good that we will see the deployment of that. And that is the future. DPIN is going to be amazing. It's going to be huge. But in terms of its adoption curve, it's still very early on.
So as a value investor, we probably will miss out on the short-term returns that a meme coin would give us. But dollar cost averaging into a DPIN project will probably place us in a better position over the long run. So in terms of being a value investor, we will place ourselves in a better position in terms of ROI as dollar cost averaging into a DPIN project versus a meme coin, which might appeal for short-term returns, but is highly risky and volatile and is not a year, 5 years from now, most likely.
Yes, exactly. This is how I think about it. The more retail in the space, the more aggressive you need to be as a trader. And where you want to buy good things is in the bear market, right? Like I said, I spend so much of my day thinking about liquidity. Where is liquidity flowing and how's it going to flow? And I just want to be ahead of the liquidity because my personal belief is that all of these crypto tokens are valueless by their name. They're utility tokens, right? So they have a utility, but if there is no demand for the utility, what's its value? Zero. And if you take the view that all crypto tokens are worthless, they only have value because people are willing to buy it. That's why memes, they're all memes, right? They just take different guises. So the only reason why they have bid is because there's people that want to either use it as utility or want to speculate on it. That's it. Therefore, that's liquidity. If you believe that the project's not going to have much liquidity, then you shouldn't buy it. If you think that it's going to attract a lot of liquidity, then buy and hold it, right? If you think about just Bitcoin in itself, a lot of people smarter than me have written a lot of papers on how to value Bitcoin. I've spent a good portion of the last 8 years of my life thinking about how to value a Bitcoin. But part of me just goes, Bitcoin's also worthless. If you think about it, again, it only has value because people are willing to pay for it. Like you've got the network there securing things, but all cryptos are the same, right? As long as there's a bid there, it has a value. But that's why they lose 90% of their value when we go into a bear market, because the bid isn't there. It's a dangerous like thought experiment to take, because you could draw it back to anything. Food has no value because someone might want to buy the food, right? But, you know, we need to eat the food to live, right? So you could abstract the argument out, but for Bitcoin, it's different. Like I said, I think a lot about it. And I want to just make it clear that I do think it has value, but I can argue with myself that it doesn't. But I think the majority of altcoins just simply don't have value. Memes have no value. They are just the consequence of liquidity. And liquidity wants to flow into memes right now. So let's trade memes. But when the liquidity flows out, I will happily flow out and I won't be stuck holding a meme coin. Well, it represents a nice picture in a community. No, fuck that. I don't give a shit about it. I just want it while it's hot with, and there's liquidity behind it.
Or represents a cult. I actually want to share a perfect example of what you just described. We have here Pepe. And Pepe got listed on Coinbase like 2 days ago. And it's also on Robinhood. You can finally have access to it on Robinhood. And I think this years ago would have been unthinkable to be on a major retail app, a meme coin. And going to your point, you can see here this spike in price potentially related to these listings and access to liquidity. And one of the metrics that I see here on CoinMarketCap, I'm not sure your take on this, but they even attribute a liquidity score. And that seems quite interesting on each SEX or DEX.
Liquidity to me is the most important thing in any market. So if you go back to 2020, when COVID first became a global threat, and you go and look at gold, which is the safe haven, right? You buy gold when things get bad. Gold collapsed along with every other asset. So why did that happen? And that's because liquidity got sucked out of the market. If there is no bid near the mid price and the nearest bid is 10% lower than the mid price, it'll go down 10%. A lot of people don't ever think about order books. They think that an order book is just a block of orders, both sides to zero and infinity. But it simply isn't. Every order is someone else, whether it's someone else through a bot or it's someone else placing an order. It's someone else and it's someone else's capital. 2020, it'll be that flash crash at just further along. No, that's go back to 2020. Yeah. To the left a bit more. Yeah, around there. That'll be it. That huge dump there.
And where did this liquidity got pulled to? Was just investors holding liquid cash so they have access to opportunity in the market during a recession?
Yeah, so that's part of it. So it's a mix, right? The amount of leverage in the US financial system is greater than the amount of actual capital in the world. You've probably seen like the images of how much debt there is. Like you could include leverage in that. So because there's so much leverage in the system, particularly quant funds now, that's a systematic threat to the US, well, to any financial system, is how leveraged the quant funds get to capture spread, right? There's so much leverage in the system that when everything collapses, people get margin called. And a margin call is essentially you need to have X percentage of how much you borrowed in your account at all times. So you get a collapse in risk assets. People start to sell other assets to fund margin calls. And then you get this cascading thing where everything's going down. People are getting stop loss. So when they stop loss, they auto liquidate. So you had this liquidity event. All the liquidity got sucked out of the sort of global financial system at once. And everything went down. And sure, some people were like, let's get ahead of it and let's move to cash now so we can buy things cheap. But that just goes to show what happens when liquidity disappears from a market. Even the asset that's meant to go up when everything goes down, went down. That's a liquidity issue. You have to think about liquidity, particularly in our industry, because it is extremely liquidity driven. There's a small amount of, well, it's not small, it's getting bigger, but relatively small pool of capital that's on chain and hasn't, like I said, hasn't really changed from cycle to cycle, from our last cycle.
Just recycling now.
Yeah. So it's just PVP. It's just running around and recycling through, buying narratives, buying meme coins currently. And as a result, you don't get momentum. Again, to go back to what I was saying earlier on the call, you've got this enormous investable universe with a kind of stagnant investable pool of capital. So you can't expect assets to catch bid like they used to. The fact that Pepe's now on Coinbase means that it will get the retail bid when it comes. So get long Pepe, right? Not financial advice, but like simply based on where liquidity is going to flow, because the Coinbase app is in the West. That's what people in America use to buy crypto. Americans have so much liquidity. M2 monetary supply is at a crazy number. It's like almost at all-time highs. I think it sits around like 21 trillion, which is an insane number. Energy money supply is cash easily converted, or assets that are easily converted into cash, right? That's a lot of money that can flow in to assets. In the US, there's only a certain amount of assets that they can buy, and they're probably just on Coinbase. So you best understand every one of those assets and how liquidity is going to touch them, because I could probably bet you that when you get that retail surge and they look on Coinbase and there's like a list of like maybe 100 projects that they can buy, what are they going to buy? It's going to be one of those 100. It might be all of it. And what's the delta of people that actually get off Coinbase and go into DeFi? You know, it's good for us if it's like 80, 90%, because that's real adoption of DeFi. And then DeFi starts to become what it needs to be. But it might be like 5, 10%.
And I'm glad you touch upon that. Do you think it's ready, as it's been so much friction in terms of UI, UX, the learning curve of what is LSD? How can I go and stake and unstake, use MetaMask, use XYZ? Do you think we'll be ready to onboard millions of people? And also, Ethereum already started having its fees going up, and we're not even started. What is your take on this?
I think that crypto in general is not just DeFi. I think crypto in general is not ready for mass adoption. One of the main important things about crypto is self-custody. Like, you have sovereignty of wealth. A lot of people shouldn't have access, shouldn't be custodying their own funds. I've been in the space like 8 years. Do you know how many private keys I've lost and the net value of money I've lost as a result? It's embarrassing. I have good procedures. A lot of people don't have good procedures. And a lot of people will just create an account. They'll send it to a wallet they just set up, and they might lose the keys. But also, this space is still rife with scams and phishing scams and people who contact you on Telegram. And so many people should not be navigating this space. Like, you need a fucking university degree to do crypto now, not just to be like a crypto trader or like a crypto dev. Forget that. Just operation in crypto needs like a year's worth of study, because this, I imagine just yourself, how many times have you been in a position where you could have been scammed, or you have been scammed, you've had money drained, you've lost the wallet? Like, everyone who's been in the industry that I know for some time has paid a tuition fee.
For sure. And I'm actually happy to share this story really quick. I was indeed scammed. It was like $1,000 back in 2016, 17, my first run. And I was trying to sell Bitcoin, and it was on local Bitcoins. And I remember that person called me, "Hey, I really need you to send me to my wallet. And I made you a payment, and the payment is in your Bank of America account." And I went to my Bank of America account and showed the check was deposited. And then I was like, okay, sure, I released the Bitcoin. And a lot of people don't understand that once you release or you send your Bitcoin to a wallet, you cannot call customer support and they will reverse the transaction. That's what happened with Bank of America. The check he deposited bounced back because the funds were not on his account. And back in the day, I was just a student, and I needed the money. And I remember I went to the police, I went to every bank, and there is nothing I could do. And it was a lesson, and I think it was part of the journey and the experience. But for everyone listening, I think get a book about Bitcoin, how to use, what is a wallet, private keys, public keys, etc., because it's completely different. There's no customer support. "Hey, Satoshi, can you send me back my Bitcoin?" No, that's not going to happen. It's the Wild West.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is the Wild West. But as people in the industry who are trying to push the industry forward, it's irresponsible for us to say yes to the broader public, come in, because so many people aren't ready. Where the adoption is going to come from is the younger generation. That's where you're going to start to see the shift. And you're starting to see the shift now. You mentioned that 30K fuck you thing, right? That, how old was that kid?
I think it was around 15 years old, or maybe even younger. I can pull it up.
But it goes to show you, when you grow up using computers and you're on computers all the time, crypto isn't so foreign. But the generations older than us,
there is
that learning curve. And do they want to, like, it's funny, think about telling your parents or your uncles, aunties, or grandparents, or whoever is a good few years older than you, to go and put like a good portion of their wealth into Pepe, because in 10 months' time, Pepe might have doubled or tripled. They're going to go, what the fuck is Pepe? And I'm not putting any money into that. This is nothing. It's ridiculous. Yeah, this is it, right?
Yeah, this is it. So it was just...
Mate, that kid, I don't know if he's 15 even. Like,
yeah, it was live streaming doing the trade and then he just rugs. And it was quite interesting how the crypto community took revenge and drove the price of the token up so much that he missed out on about 2 point something million yeah. later on.
But that's crazy, huh? But man, when you're 15, you got 30K. Do you give a shit?
I don't think I would even know what money is at that point or what.
Yeah, exactly. But these are the people. It's this generation that's going to be the ones that where we're going to see the real global adoption of crypto, the day-to-day use of it. And it needs to be people who are growing up using computers, using the internet.
I think it's fascinating. If I started at age 14 and had access to internet with high speed and was already on a deck screener and playing out with wallets, I couldn't imagine myself where I'll be at 30.
Absolutely. That's the thing. Every cycle I look back on and take the learnings and I'm like, shit, man, I could have made so much more money if I just was a bit smarter or spent a bit more time or thought about something a bit more deeply. Just on that point as well, I think it's important to note for anyone trying to get into crypto or even who people who've been in crypto for a while, no other industry ever in my mind has paid curiosity so well. For instance, if you just were curious about what Bitcoin was in 2008, 2009, and you just bought it up and did nothing, you could potentially be a billionaire right now from being curious, right? Same goes with Ethereum. Same goes with the early DeFi traders. Same goes with the early GameFi people. Same goes with all the early meme punters. These people have made life-changing wealth in a very short period of time simply because they're curious about an innovation. And I always keep that in the back of my mind because the more that you understand these innovations, be it just a meme coin, like, regardless of how stupid a meme coin is, it's an innovation, right? So if you just understand it, how's it going to be perceived by the market? What is it going to do? And what's its capacity to handle capital, i.e. liquidity, in a reasonable fashion before it becomes a bubble? If you ask yourself these questions, then you can have a framework with which to think about these crypto projects. And like I mentioned, there is a glut of projects coming to market. So many of them are not positioning themselves well within the hype cycle, within the market narrative, within the broader market cycle. They're not taking a cerebral view of what does the market need? What is the product it needs? And you get this cross-section of people building. But
Nick, what is your opinion or sort of strategy in terms of exiting? As I want to touch upon, and I keep seeing this repeating every cycle, I think it's part of human behavior, but we always look back and think, what if I did this? What if I exited? And a lot of times when we're at the peak of the hype, we keep buying and we see our portfolio growing and I just need more X amount or Y, then I exit. But people end up not exiting or building a strategy and then they end up losing everything. Is there any best practice you've seen here over time?
It comes to what are you holding? The people who have lost a lot of their money generally at the end of the bull market are the ones that have got heavily long alts and never sold them. If you were heavily long Bitcoin, no matter when you bought it, as of today, you're in profit, right? I don't know. I think we hit a new all-time high at it. Maybe yeah, unless you bought it like 5 minutes ago or something like that, you hit a loss. But that's a very small percentage of people in the world. Yeah, we crossed the all-time high like 3 hours ago, four hours ago. So unless you're one of the unlucky few people in the world that bought Bitcoin 4 hours ago, you're in profit right now. And honestly, the same for me. If I just bought Bitcoin and only continued to buy Bitcoin and nothing else, I think on average, I would probably have made a lot more money than I have, right?
Wow.
Right? Because the alts, they run so hot, but you're limited in liquidity. Once they start going down, generally they go down. These are structural issues for just how tokenomics works. Like once a project begins its inflation, unless there's equal or greater demand coming in relative to what the supply coming to market is, it's going to go down because that's how price works. Price is the intersection of supply and demand curves. So the 99% of altcoins just trend down forever. And so in terms of exiting, I use a lot of trading signals. The best trading signal for me for getting out the peak is when retail is in a fever, like a crypto fever. Get out then. Get out into what? Just park into cash. Or just keep buying Bitcoin, right? Just keep dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin, because no asset has performed as well as Bitcoin has in the last decade, right? It's just facts. So why make it hard for yourself buying all of these shitty altcoins that are going to go up and go down, have these short life cycles? But if you are, understand that of altcoins, it's a very small percentage that come and cross their high from the previous cycle ever, right? You're talking a very small pool of projects.
Maybe more of the ones with a strong utility case or that strong demand, which there's a lot of applications built on top. I guess Ethereum is a good example. There's a whole ecosystem built on it. It thrives with an insane TVL amount, and over every cycle you see it, it's still around.
Yeah. But there's not many Ethereums, right? Obviously, Solana is performing well, like Dogecoin, which is interesting. But there's very small pools. So you can't think about cryptos as like, oh, this project's doing this really innovative thing and it's going to change the world. Because sure, maybe at some point they will do that. But a lot of the projects that launch, the technology's not built, right? So they launch a project on an idea, they raise money on that, they launch the token. Eventually they become like in their tokenomics, they have team allocations, they have company allocations. They sell that token to fund the building of the company or just to cash out. And in most cases, people just go and buy yachts or apartments, right? No, not yachts. I don't think many people make that much money, but it's in itself, within the launch of every altcoin, they're time limited because so many of them don't ever bring the utility to market that attracts enough demand for them to continue to grow in value, right? Sorry, in price. Obviously, as the more they inflate, the valuation will increase. But the price thing is the real issue because people buy at a certain price.
If you want to let us know a little bit more what you do and your firm, I think that could also be really interesting.
Sure. Yeah. So I run Trireme. Trireme is a market maker. We also have an incubator. We work with projects essentially full life cycle from like a idea stage through to helping with go to market, all aspects of that. We list it on the exchanges, we trade it, we help maintain liquidity, like I was saying, how important that is, hence why I think about liquidity so much. We help build treasury, we help diversify the treasury, we help make sure that the project will last from cycle to cycle. And through my sort of 8 years in the industry, I've worked with top 10 projects. I've worked with top performing projects within their vertical. I've been responsible for some of the top performant launches in the history of the industry, some of the largest in terms of valuation. And through doing all of that, I've had a very hands-on, real experience with how the dynamics of altcoins work and how to manage a treasury around that and how to make a project sustain. And I'm like quite happy to say that of the projects that I've worked extremely close with, they're still running, right? And that's better than 99% of the stuff that launches. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. And as a matter of fact, that's what we try and do at Trireme. Where most market makers, you're essentially exchanging value for depth in the sense that if you're a project, you're going to pay them a fee for depth, or you're going to just give them a bunch of supply and they can abstract the value out of that in exchange for the depth. Our approach is always, we're here as a long-term partner to try and make sure that the project will last. And you do that by making sure that you've taken a proper strategic view of the treasury, that you're always maintaining strong liquidity, because I, you know, as I mentioned several times on this call, liquidity is so goddamn important. If you don't have liquidity, no one can trade it. No one can trade it. What's the value? It goes to zero.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. One last question. I'm getting asked lately this from a lot of founders, and I think even from the founders listening. What are your thoughts on launching on a launchpad? Do you think it makes sense? Is there one that you've seen really good work coming from? And overall, should founders look into doing that or more traditional raise?
So I actually have a lot of experience with launchpads. In the last cycle, I was the CFO of DAOmaker, which at the time was the number one launchpad. And while I was there, I did all of the market making, launch planning, listing of all of their top launches. The game has changed on launchpads now a lot. We're not seeing the performance that we used to. And as a result, the kind of retail who would be buying off launchpads has gone elsewhere. So they're not as exciting as they used to be. They obviously still have merit. Certain projects need a launch pad. I think that in general, a big issue that traders, investors on the secondary market face is the fact that projects now, particularly in this cycle, have done these quite large raises at multiple rounds so that by the time the project comes to launch, the VCs in the back is in so much profit, doesn't make any sense to hold it. They just should sell and realize the gain, right? Why I think meme coins are performing so well is because they're very traditional in the sense of what is it, how should a crypto launch, i.e. fair launch. All the supplies on the market at once. You could say that there's no VC backing. And if you remember back when you said you were trading around 2016, 17, all the ICO mania, one of the key things that you would look for in the ICO was no VCs, no pre-mine, i.e. it's a fair launch. That's why ICOs went off, because everyone could buy this ICO at the same price. They would say, okay, we're opening this round of X value to the public and you can all buy it at this point. And everyone used to buy that and everyone got it at the same level. So you didn't have anyone really dumping it anyways, except probably the team. If you think about what launch pads were back in the last cycle, it was still quite similar. Where we were doing this at DAO. I'm not sure what they're doing now, but like generally the VC round and the public round was either the same or the delta was tiny, right? Everyone's getting it at the same level. If you look at a lot of the projects coming to launch pads now, the dynamic shifted where there's quite a large delta between the rounds of like seed, private, and then where public is. And people are generally raising public for a reason of they need liquidity for exchanges, or they want to buy more, pay for more exchange listings. And there's these refund clauses from the launch pads where if the price drops below X, people can get a refund. So what's that mean? You get these weird launches where it lists everyone wants to sell, including all the VCs, right? And then it drops below the level where people can get refunds. So everyone goes for a refund and then the project ends up basically with no money. It was a wasted exercise. Maybe they got some marketing out of it, but net's probably negative. That's how the vast majority of IDOs off launch pads have happened this year. As a matter of fact, 88% of them are trading below IDO price. So think about that. 88% of launches this year are trading below, of good launches this year from, and I say good launches from a launch pad, right? They've been selected by a launch pad. And this is when I did this, it was including top launch pads. There's a lot of launch pads now. So I don't, obviously the number's a lot higher if we include like meme coins, and it's probably like 99%, but 88% of IDOs trading below IDO price this year. That means retail have lost money. VCs have lost money. So what's that do to the velocity of money? What's that do to liquidity in the space? It squeezes it and shuts it down. So we need this huge push in the major caps now just to revive things so that we can get this trapped liquidity out and put it into other alts. And that's another reason why you'll see a lot of these tech alts just won't perform well, because the VCs are trapped in them, and then the retail are trapped in them, and then the project also wants to sell their assets because that's what projects like to do. So,
yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The system's become a bit rotten. I think a return to the more fair launch approach is good. I think what launchpads should do is maybe this works, is you just go, there is no VCs. Like this, we like this idea. There's going to be no VCs backing it at all. But the raise we're going to do might be like 5 million off a launch pad, and everyone comes in at the same level, and the VCs and everyone else. And if you want a bigger ticket, contact us or whatever like that. That makes a lot of sense, right? Because that's traditionally how crypto launches should be. It's meant to be fair. That's what a launch pad's meant to do, right? It's meant to democratize investing. So it's a good idea. I might take it for myself, to be honest, now I say it, but...
So if you're a founder, would you just raise from traditional VCs or still going to a launch pad?
It depends what I'm doing. Like a big issue that I see with the market is that people are launching their project as a form of capital raising so that they can generate more alpha to pay themselves and build the company. Sorry, generate more dollars to pay themselves and build the company. That's obviously really bad for the token and any retail or secondary market player who buys the token. What I recommend is if you're building something that is quite technically resource heavy to build and requires a lot of capital, maybe it makes sense to go to a VC. Or just like I just said, maybe Launchpad to just do like enormous raises with no VCs, but it's locked for ages or something like that. There's more structure around it, so they can't just exit scam. But if you're launching like a project that doesn't necessarily need all that much development, you just need a certain capital. Yeah, the Launchpad could make sense. But the issue with Launchpads is that so many of the people who are playing around with those type of projects are underwater, right? Like 88% is a real number. That's a big number of projects that people have lost money in.
Yeah, that's a scary number for investors. Nick, it was a pleasure. If our listeners would like to follow on with your work and learn more, where should they go?
They can go to trireme.com, T-R-I-R-E-M-E.com. And we've got a contact box. You can contact us there.
All right. That was a wrap. Great.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to catching up soon.
Thanks for tuning in to the Chain Stories podcast, where disruptors become trailblazers. Don't forget to subscribe to hear more inspiring stories from those who are pushing boundaries in digital assets. Brought to you by Dropout Capital, where bold vision transforms into reality. Check out our social media links down below and visit us online at dropout.capital. And remember, the future belongs to those who dare to challenge the norm.